Well, stay tuned. Coming up in the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Tom Fisher, taking a look at the agenda for Wednesday's County Council meeting. Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson with a preview of Wednesday's Planning Commission meeting, the PEG Company's Park City Mountain Resort base project back on the agenda. And finally, PC Mark Wellness Coordinator Cole Johnson will be telling us more about this month's free virtual lunch and learn and the reopening of the Mark. Stay tuned. It's 8:09 now. Good morning. Well, it was a busy weekend for Summit County Sheriff deputies as they responded to a rash of vehicle burglaries in the Snyderville Basin. KPCW's Carolyn Murray has more.
Seven vehicles in the Powder and Silver Springs neighborhoods were broken into last weekend. Cards, small amounts of cash, and other personal items were stolen. Two of the cases involved an attempt to use credit cards at a Smith's grocery store in Salt Lake City. Investigators are awaiting the footage from the store manager to identify the suspects. In another case, a credit card, driver's license, two N95 masks were stolen from an unlocked vehicle. Also in this case, the credit card was used at a Salt Lake City Smith's. Another report from Quails Drive in Silver Springs states a wallet was taken from a vehicle. Sheriff's deputies received a report which involved a suspect taking a fishing bag and about $500 of tools from an unlocked vehicle. While deputies were investigating other vehicle burglaries in the area, an unnamed victim approached and said both driver and passenger side windows had been broken in their vehicle, although nothing was reported missing. Summit County Sheriff's Lieutenant Andrew Wright says the crimes of opportunity often increase when spring arrives. He says it's easy for criminals to take advantage when valuables are left in vehicles and the doors are left locked.
It's a little bit easier for these criminals to be out when it's not so cold and the weather is nicer. You know, a lot of people are a lot more active during the spring and summer months and leave a lot of different items in their vehicles. So don't leave anything in your car that you wouldn't want someone to get their hands on. And definitely don't leave anything within plain view. Lock your vehicle at all times, and whether it's daytime or nighttime.
Lieutenant Wright says the criminals will immediately try to use stolen credit cards, often before the victim knows it's been taken.
Those criminals using those credit cards gives us a little bit of an evidence trail that we're able to follow. Usually these stores are very cooperative with law enforcement and providing any kind of surveillance footage. I understand that the Smith store that these credit cards were used at was down in the Salt Lake Valley. I understand our deputies have requested the video surveillance.
Wright says people should take vehicle break-ins seriously and to not leave valuables in sight. He says make it harder for the thieves and lock your vehicle. Call the sheriff's office if suspicious behavior is observed, especially if someone is wandering around your neighborhood late at night. I'm Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
8:13 now. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Well, the Summit Council meets Wednesday starting about 4:15 via Zoom. On the phone with a preview of the agenda, Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Leslie.
The major item is that the council will get introduced to the Kimball Junction Area Plan. The four major goals of the plan are, at this point, vague and conceptual. Bottom line, though, it's doing something to relieve, I believe, the traffic congestion there, congestion at Kimball Junction.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we've all known anecdotally and visually and experience-wise that there's a problem out there, especially on our heavy traffic days. When we're trying to outload the ski areas, we certainly have some issues with the three series of signals, including the interchange, and that's also it backs up the ramp coming into Park City when we have those days. This really grows out of the land use planning that was done around this area that finished last year. And, you know, in working with UDOT closely on that project, they really wanted to help put something together that starts the process of how we figure out what to do out there with the state highway agency, and then, of course, how to fund it over time.
So we've talked about a freeway overpass to bypass Kimball Junction. Is that in the cards here?
I don't think anything's off the table at this point. There are some land use constraints out there. There's dedicated and protected with conservation easement open space that does constrain that area in some ways, plus the development that's already happened out there. So all of that will be taken into consideration as they come up with options.
So, again, is UDOT involved in this as well?
Oh, very heavily. I mean, it's the interchange is theirs. It intersects with I-80, and obviously the state highway is theirs as well. So they are the major player. However, a lot of local stakeholders need to be heard from in order to get a full picture of what is needed out there. And that you know, the whole corridor plan would cover everything from Deer Valley to this interchange with a concentration on this interchange.
Oh, wow. So what other projects could be possible?
Well, I think really, you know, we've already talked about having bus rapid transit in the corridor. So that's going to get figured into this. And, you know, that project alone will change the character of 224. But, you know, the real choke points that have been experienced over the years are those signals that lead into the commercial development around Kimball Junction.
So are you just looking then up to White Pine Canyon Road, or is this kind of a joint exercise? I mean, if you're mentioning to Deer Valley, it seems like we need to involve city folks as well, huh?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the major destination that people that are traversing 224 off of I-80 include all the way to Deer Valley. And include Park City, include the Park City Mountain Base, include the Canyons Base, and all the neighborhoods in between. So all of those folks should want to be involved in what the solutions will in the future will be for this corridor. That's what's being encouraged right now is as much participation as possible.
Well, the staff report mentioned that there were 200 responses to the online survey. When will we see those results?
You know, I'm not sure of the specific timeline. That's a good question that I'm sure Caroline will be asked tomorrow. And this is supposed to be as it's described in the staff report, it's supposed to be a robust public engagement, community engagement, business engagement effort in order to come up with the solutions. So that's one of the things we'll be finding out tomorrow.
All right. And 200 doesn't sound robust in a county.
Not yet.
Yeah.
No, certainly not. And I tell you, the current situations we're under with COVID response and over the last 2 months have had an impact on how public involvement is done. And so it may be that the schedule will change because of that.
Sure. And we have heard from citizens for years who would like to see an underpass, an overpass, something at the Blue Roof intersection. Have you heard from any of those folks as well? I mean, they can also provide input?
Absolutely, they can provide input. I personally have not heard from them in regards to this study. Of course, I've heard the input on pedestrian or bicycle facilities at that intersection. And I would imagine that we'll see public comment in regards to that for the study.
And I'm guessing all of this, any of this, would require some kind of environmental NEPA process?
Oh, absolutely. This is really a kind of a first step in UDOT's process in order to get future projects that would be funded and included in the state transportation improvement program that programs out their dollars 5 to 7 years in advance. So as these projects are identified and then pulled, specific funding identified for them, that's when they move into the STIP and then into their environmental and design process.
Now, fund for this, I mean, you mentioned about the cost. I mean, funding, my understanding, was supposed to come from like the 1/4 and 1/5% sales taxes that voters approved a few years ago. But it feels like most of that money was directed toward the Jeremy Pinebrook roundabouts and then even bonded for that. Is there?
Yes. So early on, the funding that went towards the Jeremy Pinebrook interchange, that was an early on project for some of those funds. And, you know, there will be future rounds of funding for those funds that will go to projects along this corridor between at the intersection of I-80 and 224. But that we're talking tens of millions of dollars worth of projects that will have to have local participation, state participation, and probably federal participation. And that's really what these studies are about, is identifying what levels of funding are needed in order to advance certain projects. It starts that conversation.
All right. Yeah. I mean, you said tens of millions. For some reason, I was thinking like 70 million, but was it even more than that?
Well, it could be. I mean, we know the bus rapid transit project, but just by itself is upwards of a $50 million project. That much highway work, interchange work, and, you know, the possibility of separating 224 from pedestrian access, it's an expensive project.
All right. Speaking of money, I mean, I heard this morning on the news that we are in a recession. So what does that mean for Summit County and the budget going forward?
Well, I mean, you've already seen some of the action start in regards to that, where in late April, early May, the council made about $5 to $6 million worth of adjustments to the operating budget. We have more work to do in that regard. We still have to deal with some of our other sales tax supported expenditures like transit, like the county fair, and other things that are supported by those sales taxes that are obviously very affected by this economic activity. So we're going to be doing more of that. We're just kind of getting the May sales tax numbers from the state. We would like to have June's numbers before we make those adjustments, just so that we can make sure that we have enough trend information to make a good call on that. So you will see some of the adjustments come forward in July. At the same time, we will start our budget process for 2021, which will be even a more difficult task, not really knowing what our winter is going to look like, and not from the standpoint of weather, really standpoint of what our business activity will be. And we're going to have to make some guesses on that based on what the industry is telling us and indicating to us, so that we can make sure that we don't overexpend and have our revenues correct.
All right. Let's see. Is there anything else on the agenda that you wanted to mention before I move on with a couple of other topics?
Well, the only thing out there is that we're reacting to a law that was passed in the legislature in regards to public safety retirement, where it raises the contribution by about 2.27%. Gives the option to employers, public employers, to either pay it by the employer or have employees pay it. Our experience from around the state, it has to be put in place by July 1st, so far most municipalities and counties are covering that out of the local government's side of that, not the employer's side. So the council needs to make a choice about that. And it has a slight impact of about $50,000 to a yearly budget.
All right. Let's see. Let's talk a little about the latest on COVID-19. Are we staying in yellow given the spikes we've seen?
Well, we haven't gotten a good indication from the state where they're going this week. You know, based on the choice to stay in yellow last week by the state, as well as the continued growth in caseload, I mean, we have not had a slow day in about the last 10 days. I would expect we're going to stay there, but that's just based on past activity. I have not gotten anything specific from the state on that to let me know.
Yeah, the Salt Lake Tribune also reporting some concerning allegations that the testing that we've been doing now not accurate.
Yeah, I would have to defer to the health department and Rich Bulla on that. He is much closer tied to that than I am.
Okay, we hope to get him on later this week. What about any reaction to the George Floyd protest situation? Can you talk about the mood among the officers and our sheriff deputies?
Well, I would defer to the sheriff in regards to county law enforcement on the actual mood of the sheriff's office or what he's projecting in that. I think everybody's concerned about this issue. We're seeing it across the country. We're seeing it locally, and certainly leaders across our state are concerned about the issue. And I believe that it's an indicator of a much larger issue that we will all be talking about and have been talking about for a long time.
Yeah. Have you heard from any council members wanting to talk about defunding the sheriff's office? Basically, I mean, what I think I'm hearing on a national basis is defunding isn't taking money away, but it's rather reshifting the funds from police officers and their equipment to community policing and other social programs. Has that been brought up?
We have not had any time that has been dedicated to that type of conversation. I would expect that our attorney's office, the sheriff's office, and the council will be talking about those types of issues over the next few weeks.
And certainly our leaders don't represent our county's diversity, and that's up to voters in terms of that. But do you think the county's policies explicitly state that it is anti-racist? I mean, do we know that the county's practices aren't biased? Have we ever looked into whether or not they aren't biased?
Well, I mean, we have been working on bias awareness across our organization really for the last 2 to 3 years. We have had several trainings across our workforce. We have brought in people and consulted with people to look at our personnel policies specifically. And I can talk from that from a general administration of the county point of view. So it is something that we're constantly working on. It is not a line in the sand where we can say we've achieved anything in it. It's a constant process, and of course with bias, these are things that are part of us. The best thing that we can do is be aware of them and how we apply them to our workplace.
All right. Also, wearing your National Guard Brigade Commander hat, can you talk about your participation in planning the logistics of sending Utah National Guard members to Washington, D.C. last week?
Yeah, I sure can. I mean, because of the level, the numbers of people that were being called, and that equals, you know, we had about 120 to 150 people on active service for COVID already. We brought on another 200 that are specifically trained on a yearly basis to do law enforcement support type work. So they were in Salt Lake City, and then we had another 200 that were sent to Washington D.C. To assist the District of Columbia National Guard with their efforts.
So exactly what is the role of the National Guard? Is it to protect the state of Utah, or is it to protect our country? And I think there seems some confusion.
In normal times, if we're not federalized, which means that the president has not called us up, we work for the governor. So our main job is to train for a federal mission. So we have different types of units that are the same as active Army units. And they've done that mission, but they are an asset of the state and of the governor in order to respond to natural disasters or assisting local governments with different types of issues that the governor wants to assist with. So that really, that's the role we were fulfilling over the last week or so in supporting law enforcement in Salt Lake City and then supporting law enforcement in the District of Columbia.
All right. So since the president is the commander in chief, it is he who is responsible for ordering the Guard troops to various locations.
Well, it's actually a nuance because although the president is the commander in chief, the folks that went to Washington were not federalized. They were under what's called essentially we have agreements between our National Guards to assist when needed. So it was actually the D.C. National Guard and our National Guard Bureau in Washington that arranged for several states to support the D.C. National Guard in their efforts in the district.
All right. And then you mentioned that some Guard members are specifically trained then to do what these folks were sent to Washington, D.C. to do to support law enforcement.
That's correct. We do that because there is a contingency that kind of support is needed by local governments. Just as we train to help with any kind of fire control that would be needed during the year, or earthquakes, floods, all of those types of activities, we have packages of units and soldiers ready to go. For different kinds of contingencies, and they spend some of their year training on those in order to be ready.
So certainly a lot of planning and thought went into this, and then just a short 5-day stay. I guess any lessons learned?
Well, I mean, I think the biggest lesson learned for us was that a lot of our plans that were already in place and the training that we had done actually worked. In reviewing this with other military officers in the Utah Guard, we can't remember a time where we've had this level of activity supporting law enforcement, especially for this type of happening. It has not happened in the modern era when we've been active. So really in the last 30 to 31 years. So the fact that we were trained well enough in order to integrate with law enforcement and support their efforts and do so quickly, either moving those folks to Washington, D.C. to help there, or even, having people on the ground within 2 or 3 hours helping the Utah Highway Patrol at the Capitol, our plans worked, and that was gratifying.
All right. Tom, I'm going to leave it there. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much.
That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. Stay tuned. Conversation with Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson next. The Park City Planning Commission meets virtually on Wednesday starting at 5:30. Directions about how to join in can be found online at parkcity.org under the Meetings tab. On the phone now with a preview of the agenda, I have Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning, Leslie.
In work session, the Planning Commission will consider some opportunities to require electric vehicle charging station infrastructure for all new development and redevelopment. So tell me why we are focused on car chargers, as opposed to solar panels.
Because solar panels are pretty much deregulated throughout the town, except in the historic district where we have some restrictions on it. But electric vehicle charging stations are coming forward. This is already constructing some. We need to have a conversation about requiring these and how many of these in each new development, how it affects the required parking for each development. So that's the conversation we're going to have with the Planning Commission is we're talking about requiring the conduit during construction, which is sort of the tube where all the wires go. In each new development, but we have not yet determined how many spaces are required per unit or per project size.
So this is based on knowing that that's where we're headed to? I mean, that's the future of transportation, electric vehicles?
Oh, Leslie, I don't know. In the interim region, which is the next decade, electric vehicles are going to be really important because they're very efficient and they don't pollute as much as regular vehicles in the short run operation.
Yeah,
so we're trying to plan for it and make sure that we get it done. It'll help us towards our net zero goal. You know, if you said you were going to take your electric vehicle from here to lab, at this point, you'd probably want to find a charging station fairly halfway in between. But in 5 years, you may be able to go to Moab in your electric car.
Right, because at this point, I don't think anybody wants an electric car until they can go 300 miles and be, you know, fully charged in 10 minutes. Some of the chargers that you're talking about at a cost of $400 to $6,500, it sounds like it still takes like an hour just to add another 60 miles onto the vehicle. So why not go for the fast chargers?
It depends on which class charger you have. The class 3 chargers will do it way faster than the class 1 chargers, but they're way more expensive. So we're just going to start this conversation and trying to move towards our sustainability goals with the Planning Commission.
So the proposal, as I understand it, is to require that 10% of all new park spaces would have this electric vehicle charging infrastructure?
That's the conversation at this point, yes.
All right. So does this mean that the development then at the Park City and Deer Valley parking lots would be required to install these?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. And speaking of chargers, we've got more electric bikes in Park City than we do electric cars. What about electric bike chargers?
Oh, that's a new one on me. I don't know how to answer that one at this point. You know, I think we have enough electric bikes for the time being. I'm not sure that the electric bikes are being used for what their intention was, which was commuting. They appear to be more a recreational device. So people go out and ride for 2 hours on the e-bike, or the kids take them at 4 p.m. and go ride around.
I mean, personally owned, yeah. There's certainly two classes, I think, there that you're talking about.
Right. Yeah. No, you've seen it the same as me.
Well, let's see. In work session, some land management code amendments that would align amendments to the municipal code regarding special events. So what would these code changes do?
Well, here's the deal. Special events is really good at doing one-off or, you know, a multi-day event once or twice a year. And they do it really, really well, which is why Silly Market works, Arts Festival works, Sundance works. They're really good at it. So we're trying to take special events out of our shop, land use planning, which is really much more of a day-to-day operation than it is a one-off once a year. So we're trying to give all the responsibility we can to special events. So anyway, that's kind of the strategy between us and special events is get planning out of trying to permit every tent for every event, because it's really difficult. If you watch the resorts, they do tents. They have private plazas. They have ski races. They have all of those things, and they don't necessarily want to fall underneath our regulations. So we're trying to step away and deregulate those kind of things.
Okay. And I guess, as I read that the planners are now out of the special event business and it's all being handled by the special events and the economic development department, it makes me sound like the fox is watching the hen house here.
Yeah, other than we have a good deal of faith in Jenny Dearson and her shop in running events. And I don't know what the fox looks like at this point.
Well, you're the stickler there, yeah, making sure that everybody abides by code.
Right. So in the past, we've been a little bit heavy-handed in how we regulate tents and events. And so we're trying to lighten our hand on this stuff and see what happens when we do this.
All right. Finally, in work session, wanted to mention the Planning Commission will once again discuss the request to amend the 1998 Park City Mountain Resort Development Agreement to replace the base area master plan study concept master plan with a new master plan. So in English, this applicant asking for?
Well, the applicant is asked for, to replace the expired land use map, if you will, for lack of a better phrase, with a new land use map inside the development agreement. We're still under negotiations with the developer to see how we can do that. I think this will be a fairly simple discussion with the Planning Commission tomorrow night. This is not going to go into detail because we're still in negotiating. There may be an agreement that we're working on with the developer to figure out how to start with an amended development agreement, but there's a lot of overlapping issues inside the development agreement, mostly relating to the operation of the parking lots, transit requirements, transit improvements, historic preservation, mountain upgrade plans, and the Master Development Association. So we're trying to thread the needle here so we can move the applicant to the Planning Commission and they can start to deal with the issues they identified 2 weeks ago, which is parking, transportation, employee housing, you know, height, volume, mass, pedestrian circulation, all of those things.
So I guess I had thought that there was some the staff wants one thing and the applicant wants another thing. I think I read that the staff feels like that the project the applicant is proposing meets the definition in the Land Management Code, finds substantive modification, and therefore justifies review of the entire master plan and development.
And I think that's where what we're trying to negotiate right now, Leslie. The development agreement was designed. The existing development agreement was designed that the resort would, control the development and sell off the parcels and have subsequent developers continue to develop. Now we're trying to figure out what we're going to do when the whole parking lot gets sold off at one time and make sure that all the obligations of the development agreement are taken care of.
Okay.
So, for example, the Marriott Mountainside was part of the development agreement. That's Parcel A of the 98 agreement, and Marriott now operates that site. And that's kind of the outcome we're expecting at this point. But I think it's going to be a bit of a hybrid where we want to make sure that the ski area and the base area are aligned for parking, transit, transportation, affordable housing, and a master association.
Well, let's talk about...
Go ahead.
Let's just talk about what people are asking for. I think people want to see more of a village flow rather than this conflict between pedestrian and vehicles. Do we have that project yet?
We're working on that right now. I mean, this is the initial development proposal coming in. We're not sure that this is what's going to come out the other end in October. I expect we're going to have some really hard conversations about pedestrian circulation through the project. They are proposing some sidewalks and a couple other things and a change to the transit center. We're working on those things right now.
And do we even have a transit center, or are they proposing to keep what we've got now, basically a bus drop-off and pick-up location?
Well, we're working on that. The bus drop-off and pick-up could be redesigned in accordance with their proposal to make the bus circulation a little bit cleaner. We're trying to see if that's actually going to work out. And they've proposed a drop-off area down at the first time lot for shuttles and ski ski school. We're not sure that that's working right now. There's some issues with respect to being a parent of a ski school participant, having to drop off their ski school participant and then having to run up to the ski school, find the instructor, deliver the lunch, deliver the participant, and then get back to their car. So we're not sure about that right now. We're trying to figure that out.
All right. What about a separate area designed for delivery trucks so traffic flow won't be obstructed? Have you figured that out?
No.
Too technical at this point.
We're working on that as well. I mean, the deliveries to the ski area are not as bad as the deliveries to Main Street. There are areas for commissary and delivery in the master plan. We just need to make sure the trucks can get in and out of there.
Yeah. And what's with the underground parking? It sounds like we're not going to have any more underground parking. It's all going to be structured, Dean?
That's 50% correct. Most of the parking, a portion of the parking is underground. A portion of the parking is above grade, and we have no solution to that with respect to the total square footage that's allowed in the development agreement. So that's another problem that we're going to have to work on once we get through tomorrow night.
All right. And have we settled on a number of parking spots? Last time we talked, there was a difference of 600 parking spots, which is a bunch.
Yeah, the development agreement requires an additional 600 parking spaces for the ski area expansion. The developers have provided some information saying that the 600 spaces are not warranted at this point, and they're only talking about 1,200 spaces. I have not completed my analysis of how they intend to do that, and we're going to have to work through that one as well. There's a lot of hard work to do, a lot of heavy lifting this one.
What about
Planner Anant is working hard to make this work, and Planner Kermeyer is working hard to make this work.
What about the new National Ability Center headquarters? I mean, are we going to have disabled access to them?
Right now, it looks like we are. It's shown on the plan, but it's not part of this proposal. It's part of National Ability Center's proposal. I think we're going to have fairly good access on it. There's some complications on the access location right now with some Rocky Mountain Power transformers and how utilities are connected to the utility system because of the way the parking garages are located on the first-time parking lot. So we're working on it. It's in the plan. It's being coordinated as best we can.
And then for those who want to post comments, I had read in the notes that a person cannot make more than one comment per meeting. Is that true?
No, I don't believe that that's true. Once you've logged in, you can make a comment.
As many as you want.
Yeah, not all together. You're going to have to push the e-end button every time, and then it'll get read.
Well, and that was a concern of another participant, that the comments, how are the comments being put into the record? Because this person apparently didn't hear the comments being read during the meeting, even though that you had received during the meeting.
No. The person, you know, doing this virtually means we've had to restaff the entire meeting. So we have two additional people staffed to the meeting. One person is looking at the comments. The other one is looking at Granicus, which is the system that we use to maintain the order of the meeting. And they will read all the e-comments that they receive. And they did that at the last meeting. And they also did it at the last HPB meeting.
All right. And then
it's not perfect yet. truthfully, Leslie, nobody really has good software to manage a public meeting at this point. It's all kind of farmered together. So our chief of IT actually has to sit there and listen to me for 4 or 5 hours. I have one planner that's sitting there reading the e-comments. I have one planner sitting there managing the Granica system, which is how you manage the media. And then I have one person that's taking minutes. So I actually had to grow employees in order to do virtual meetings.
Well, as you should. I mean, if that's what it takes.
It's just that, you know, a couple of my people have to work a little bit longer and a little bit later in order to get these meetings done.
Well, and I guess that's a choice for our leaders then, that they can decide that maybe we hold off on the meetings if that's too much of a burden, no?
Well, I think our leaders want us to keep the meetings going. I think they're, you know, generally comfortable with how our meetings work. There's a couple of software issues that always occur. So it's pretty frantic from 4:30 to 5:30 with the IT manager trying to make sure that everybody's system is up and running and coordinated. So it's a combination of Granicus, which is the system software that manages the meeting, Zoom, which is how you do your presentations remotely, and then eComments, which is another person, and then the person taking notes and the IT manager. So it gets a little rigorous from 4:30 to 5:30 on Wednesday and Thursday.
Okay. Hey, Bruce, I need to leave it there. Hey, thanks for your time this morning.
Yep, I appreciate it, Leslie. Thanks.
Park City Planning Director Bruce Erickson. 8:52 now. Good morning. Well, this month's lunchtime learning will be led by PC Wellness Coordinator Cole Johnson. He joins me now on the phone. Good morning, Cole.
Hi, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So are you getting people to turn out for your virtual lunchtime learning sessions?
Yes. Yeah, it's been actually, this will be our second one. The first one we did in collaboration with Connect Summit County, as well as Communities That Care. And we had a great turnout. I think we had just about 30 people there, which is great, really, for an online platform. And, you know, we've got a couple RSVPs for this one, and hopefully we'll get a few drop-ins as well. So I'm looking forward to it.
All right. How do people find out how to join?
So there have been a few email blasts that have gone out. The best way, if you would like to join, you can email me directly at cole.johnston@parkcity.org, and I can get you that Zoom link or Eventbrite invitation that will have the Zoom link in there.
Okay. Let's see. Your topic is getting back out there and back to the basics. Tell us what you're going to be talking about.
So the biggest topic, or I guess the topic for tomorrow will be physical literacy, which is really exactly what it sounds. It's basically the understanding of movement and being able to move. Physical literacy is basically the competence, the confidence, and the motivation to move. And it's really not... A lot of it isn't anything that a lot of people don't already know, but a really good reminder how important it is to move. And, you know, especially after, you know, sort of being locked down for a few months, as all of us have been, you know, the importance of getting back out there and getting remotivated, you could say, to get back outside, get back to the gym, and not necessarily do something that will make you uncomfortable. But, you know, there's plenty of opportunities, especially in Park City, to get back outside and get moving again. And really just the reminder of how important that is, not only for sportlets, if that might be your passion, but really just living a long and happy life.
I don't know. It's kind of hard to get out of that routine, though, of binge watching and hornets.
Right. That's what we're going to try to talk about tomorrow, to sort of remotivate those who might need a little extra push. But really just getting back to the basics, you know, for kids as well, adults and kids, and how important physical literacy is for living a long and active, healthy life.
So talk to us a little bit about the status of the mark. I read that you're going to be lengthening the hours open.
Yep. So we have, we've expanded the hours. We began those yesterday. So those hours will now be 5:30 a.m. to 9 p.m. And I believe that's Monday through Friday. And then 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Saturday and 8 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Sunday.
Okay. So is everything open or do you still have closures?
As far as facility, pretty much everything's open. you know, we are with the with what we're currently in the governor's phased approach, the yellow plan. We are still, you know, asking those to keep social distancing. We are recommending, you know, a mask or gloves if a patron, you know, would like. But for the most part, we've reopened a lot of the machines we've had closed. We recently just opened our bouldering wall that was closed. Our locker rooms closed for the first few weeks. But most everything is open. The pool's open. And our programs are off and running. You know, we've got obviously increased protocols that we need to follow and make sure that we're being safe about it. But for the most part, we are. Our programs are running. They started this week, as well as the facilities in pretty much full swing. So it's good.
Okay, so the fitness classes and the sauna and hot tub are all open then, huh?
Correct. Yeah. So, you know, we are asking to keep social distancing, and there are certain capacities. Like, I believe only two people can be in the hot tub at a time, just for social distancing reasons. Same thing out on the pool deck. But yeah, we are running a bunch of fitness classes outdoors. You know, we've got our little park grassy area behind our facility, and we're offering a ton of classes out there where people can spread out. We're also beginning to offer classes at our Fit Park out at Quinn's. So the group fitness class is a little bit smaller. It tends to get that way this time of year anyway as people move outside. But we are still offering group fitness classes, and many of those are out.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to let us know?
I don't think so. Leslie, thanks so much for having me, and look forward to tomorrow.
Okay. Again, that's Cole Johnston with PC Mark. Thanks for your time. Again, he'll be leading the lunchtime learning that happens tomorrow, talking about getting back out there and back to the basics. Again, you can email him at cole.johnston@parkcity.org if you'd like to receive one of the Zoom invitations to see that virtually. The Snyderville Planning Commission has several items on its agenda for its regular meeting this evening. The major item is the Colby Bed and Breakfast proposal returning for a possible decision. The Snyderville Planning Commission will meet electronically at 4:30, with the first three items being requested amendments to plats or development envelopes. After that, a continued discussion on a requested conditional use permit to convert the former Colby School building to a bed and breakfast. The plan is comprised of 8 lodging units, a kitchen, and a care unit. The application has had 2 previous meetings this spring. The Snyderville Planning Commission has struggled to define an occupied unit, which is necessary to set up a B&B in Colby's rural residential zone. The owner of the property isn't one person, but a corporate LLC. The planning staff in their report has proposed that the meaning of owner is found in a section of the code and is defined as any part owner, joint owner, tenant in common, joint tenant, or lessee of the whole or of a part of such a building or land. Finally, on the agenda, the Planning Commission will hold a public hearing and consider approval for amendments to the service commercial zone. The changes are being requested by a business condominium complex located near Quinn's Junction along the Highway 40 frontage road. The applicants are asking that the county create a use designated as art space with limited public performances, which could be granted as a low-impact permit. The staff report said the proposal is a use that would be a middle ground between a rehearsal or teaching studio for performing or martial arts, as well as a full-blown theater or auditorium. In addition, the applicants are asking for an exception to the maximum building height allowance for mechanical equipment. Currently 40 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Again, looking for sunshine today with a high of 57. Clear tonight, we drop down to a low of 38, sunny and 68 on Wednesday, 77 and sunshine on Thursday, into the low 80s for Friday. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW Park City. Stay tuned. We've got headline news from NPR coming up right after that. This Green Earth. It's 9 o'clock.